Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello everyone, this is Garki. You are again with the New Books Network, and today I have Dr. Philip Tsang with me today, who would be talking about his recently published book in November last year with Johns Hopkins University Press, The Obsolete Empire. Hello Dr. Tsang, how are you today?
I'm good, how are you?
Very good, thank you. As always, I would like to start at the beginning. What is the genesis of this book? What were some initial ideas when you started writing this?
Yeah, so my book originated in my doctoral research on literary modernism. I've always been interested in questions of displacement and identity, and in how literature addresses, mediates, and complicates those questions. So when I was in graduate school, I was drawn to a group of writers who grew up in Britain's colonies or former colonies, and whose careers were shaped by the long decline of the British Empire. So four of these writers became the central subjects of my book: Henry James, James Joyce, Doris Lessing, and V.S. Naipaul. I found in their works a certain restlessness, not only in the content, but also in the style of writing. And this restlessness stems from their peripheral relation to England. So in an earlier version of this project, I tried to understand that restlessness in light of theories of cosmopolitanism. But then I found that framework to be too general and predictable. As I thought more about these writers, I realized that what ties them together is a particular pattern of frustrated attachment. This attachment has three distinct features. First, it is an unreciprocated or unrequited attachment, because these writers express a constant sense of estrangement or exclusion from England. Rather than fully reclaiming an English heritage or identity, they live in the gap between an exclusive Englishness and an expansive Britishness. They were claimed by the British Empire, but they were not desired as its proper citizens. And second, this is an improper attachment, in the sense that England appears as the wrong object of desire. These writers' longing for England is a self-consciously misplaced attachment, imbued with irony and embarrassment. And third, this is an untimely attachment. As I said earlier, these writers all grew up outside of England, and they could only construct an imaginary England from English fiction and poetry. But the actual imperial England they imagined was in decline, or you could say that it never existed in reality. So I was struck by the consistency of these three characteristics across all the writers I look at. This frustrated attachment gives rise to that restlessness I mentioned earlier, which, as I show in my book, entails a unique historical awareness, an intellectual openness, and a refusal to rest content with any fixed notions of identity and community.
Thank you for your answer. And this is, I hope, what you mean by the obsolete empire, the British Empire that is not there. But you said something very interesting, is that this empire maybe really never existed. What do you mean by that?
So what I mean is that because these writers grew up outside of England, and they were avid readers of English poetry and fiction. So the England that they that they constructed in their minds was an England that was literarily constructed, right? It's a series of literary impressions. It's frozen in time. It can only be found in books. It does not reflect the actual reality of England. So that's what I meant by an untimely attachment, right? Like this is an England that is in decline. That in reality is in decline, but it seems frozen in time in the books they read.
And you're right, and there are a series of words that are in the semantic field that you're using, untimeliness, lateness, obsolescence. Could we talk a little bit more about these terms so that we can help to distinguish clearly what we are talking about?
Sure. One of the words that I use is obsolete, right? The obsolete empire. So what I mean by that is that the British Empire has left behind not only an abundance of material relics, but also an inventory of feelings that could not be easily relinquished. So let me unpack this claim. Now, when we think of obsolete objects, we're talking about objects that may seem to have worn out or broken, but they are still there. Their obsoleteness has as much to do with their continual existence as with their degradation. So one way to think about the empire as obsolete is in terms of its material persistence, in terms of the many buildings, railroads, and museum pieces that still exist today. But what I'm more interested in is the obsolescence of subjective experience. So the premise of my book is a simple one. For people who were molded in imperial structures and institutions, they harbored a deep identification with British culture, regardless of their views on empire. And the question that I want to ask is, what happens to those identifications and desires and attachments formed during the colonial era when the political institutions that upheld them have ceased to function? So many colonial writers were preoccupied with this question. Let me give you an example. Stuart Hall begins his autobiography, Familiar Stranger, by describing himself as the last colonial, right? He says, "Sometimes I feel I was the last colonial." So technically speaking, there is no last colonial because England still has overseas territories to this day. But by calling himself the last colonial, Hall is articulating a common feeling among the writers I study. And this is a sense of finding oneself at the end of a historical line, but unable to move beyond that end. So to describe the British Empire as obsolete is to challenge the sequential logic of the end of empire. Instead, for the writers in my book, empire defers its proper ending and enters a state of perpetual suspension. And there is also an empirical sense of obsolescence to my book. When I began this project, two of the main writers were alive, but now all of them are dead. So there is a literal sense of obsolescence to my project in that the completion of my book witnessed the passing of a literary lineage, of a long succession of writers who grew up in the British Empire. So you also asked about untimeliness and lateness. Now, I think that the difference between these two terms lies in emphasis. So untimeliness is opposed to timeliness, right? So to be timely is to do the right thing at the right time. To be untimely, then, is to fail at that, is to fail to establish a proper correspondence between one's activity and time. So my book argues that untimeliness is a constitutive feature of the peripheral experience of empire. In the introductory chapter, I highlight a split between metropolitan and peripheral perceptions of imperial decline. While many English writers were eager to bid farewell to their country's imperial past, their colonial counterparts did not have the confidence or resources to declare an end to an empire that was not theirs. So the British Empire became the site of what I call untimely belonging. Untimely not because the empire has run its course, but on the contrary, because it endures as a structure of desire that outlived its political lifespan. Now, the word lateness has a broader meaning. It implies untimeliness, but it also signals an experience of time in which one cannot speak of chronology or development. Now, I borrow the term lateness from Edward Said's book On Late Style, and many scholars see this book as a departure from Said's earlier work on imperialism. But as I argue in the introduction, Said's reflections on lateness in fact extend and complicate his earlier analysis of empire. His insight that lateness is untranscendable perfectly captures the predicament facing many late colonial writers. C.L.L. James, for example, writes about his colonial upbringing in Trinidad in his book Beyond a Boundary. And he talks about how he doesn't want to be liberated from the colonial past, and he doesn't want to be liberated from the future of that past. So, like James, many writers from former British territories were at a loss to comprehend the demise of an empire to which they had no legitimate claim.
And this is very interesting that you say that. And why was this? Why was this belonging or identification among the colonial subjects persisting in these colonies? I mean, one would think that they would want to get rid of that, ideally, wouldn't they?
Yeah. So I actually addressed this dilemma in the introduction. I think that in the study of empire or in post-colonial studies, attachment is not a word that comes to mind. Instead, we are more used to thinking about anti-colonial resistance. All kinds of strategies to subvert and deconstruct colonial ideologies, but what I find in these writers and many other writers I looked at is that regardless of their views on empire, right? Some of them are anti-colonial, others are more ambivalent. Right, they harbor this deep identification with British culture, and that's why I said earlier the premise of my book is a really simple one. Right, I accept that these writers have widely divergent views on empire, but there is this lingering attachment to British culture that in turn mediates whatever views they have about empire. So my book doesn't really challenge the protocols of post-colonial studies. Instead, I'm calling for more attention to these messy and complicated feelings toward the British Empire.
Thank you for your answer. This leads us very nicely into the next question, which I want to talk about belonging and otherness, which you have discussed in the beginning of the book and also at the end of the book. And you claim that otherness is not just a question of difference that could be, I mean, easily compared with the normative. Is this correct? Is that?
Yeah, so I believe you're referring to the epilogue to my book, in which I address this paradigm of alternative modernities. So I think it's fair to say that that there is a tendency in literary studies and across the humanities to translate cultural otherness into cultural difference. right? So cultural difference comes with positive connotations. It can be affirmed and inhabited. So we're not talking about the otherness of foreign or marginal cultures. Rather, we are celebrating a plurality or diversity of cultural differences. So my question is a simple one, which is, when can otherness be recuperated as cultural difference? And when does otherness remain just otherness? So I think what's interesting about the British Empire is that it's this experience of othering in time, right? This experience of temporalized difference, as opposed to different temporalities. What we see in these writers I look at is that otherness cannot be affirmed, right? For them, they express this experience of otherness that cannot be viewed in positive terms, but can only be experienced as a chronic untimeliness. And what comes with that is a series of unrequited or conflicted or outlandish desires, right? So I'm really interested in these messy and uncorrectable feelings of being a colonial subject.
And to what extent should we take these incorrect feelings, this perversity, these affections seriously when we're talking about post-colonial literature?
Well, I think that first of all, this inventory of feelings, actually existed, right? These are experiences of many generations of colonial and peripheral writers. So part of the motivation of my book is to reclaim those feelings, right? To say that we need to look at them, right? But then I also want to think through post-colonial criticism's discomfort with those feelings, right? So why is it that we are uncomfortable when certain writers express their lingering attachment to Imperial England, right? And I think one lesson to be drawn from this is that attachment is not affirmation or endorsement, right? So I don't claim that these writers, celebrate the glory of the British Empire. That's not my point at all. But the very fact that these attachments are frustrated, the very fact that these attachments are unrequited and improper, I want to show that these troubled and troubling attachments actually coexist with other political investments, including anti-colonial ones, right? So in an unlikely way, this self-consciously misplaced attachment, this unresolved complex of shame and desire becomes for these writers a rich source of intellectual energy, right? So I want to show that these imperial attachments, which, as I said, are unreciprocated, improper, and untimely, could be as disruptive and subversive as anti-colonial projects.
Thank you. And you have read these attachments in four authors: Henry James, James Joyce, Doris Lessing, and V.S. Naipaul. The question begs itself: why these and why not others?
Yeah, so there are two main reasons why I chose these writers. The first reason is their long careers, right? So these are really prolific writers whose careers spanned decades. So this allows me to track the development of their aesthetics across a longer period of time. And the second reason is that these writers have rarely been grouped together. After all, they are very different writers and have been associated with different canons and traditions. But I take advantage of this diversity to frame The Obsolete Empire as a cross-cultural thematic. My goal is not to homogenize these writers or to argue that they share the same relation to England. And I should also stress that their views on empire are widely divergent. I don't want to say that they all express a certain attitude to England that can be summarized. What I want to demonstrate is instead a connected but varied pattern of frustrated attachment, of which these four writers are representative, but not exhaustive examples. There are many other writers that can be fitted into my book. So I have discussed some of them in my introduction. There are also other writers that I didn't have room to write about, such as Catherine Mansfield, Jean Rhys, Sam Salvin, and Jamaica Kincaid. But I hope my book can open up a fresh line of analysis for these other writers.
Yes, I completely agree with that. So let's come to now the first author, which is Henry James. And I would like to ask, what does his identification with the British Empire entail?
Now, Henry James is an interesting case. In fact, you could say that he is an outlier in my project, because he is the only writer in my book who did not grow up under British rule. But I was struck by how closely he fits into the pattern of frustrated attachment that I found in the other writers. James's identification with the British Empire manifests itself in his Anglo-Saxonism, which is an imaginary of a single united Anglo-Saxon race across the Atlantic and all over the world. So you see this Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-Saxonist rhetoric throughout his body of work. And I claim that this is not a celebration of his English heritage, pure and simple. It's not that at all. Rather, this is a peculiar imaginary filled with contradictions and paradoxes. So he calls himself the adoptive son of England. But at the same time, he cherishes his distance from the imperial capital. He would project all these fantasies about Britain's expansion in his essays. But he also seems to be ridiculing himself. So there's this playful ambiguity in his writings about England that not only unsettles the binary of English versus American, but also destabilizes the norms of national or transnational belonging, right? So this Anglo-Saxonist rhetoric is not an opportunity for him to reclaim an English heritage, but rather it is an expression of a misplaced attachment.
How could you give me an example of how does this work? How is this misplaced attachment?
Yeah. So my claim is that this Anglo-Saxonist rhetoric is not a coherent rhetoric or a coherent ideology. James would say something like he would comment on British imperial affairs, but he would also say that I can comment on them because I'm not English. Right, but precisely because I am a transatlantic alien, I'm at a better position to comment on those issues. So when we read James's early essays on England, collected in his book English Hours, we find these irrational claims about England, and he often underscores the irrationality of those claims, right? He seems to try to out-English the English, but at the same time, he would highlight how perverse those gestures are. So that's what I mean by this Anglo-Saxonist rhetoric being a misplaced attachment as opposed to a self-justified set of claims.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
When I first read your book, I was thinking about, since it is a question about race, how peripheral could this idea be? And if I understood correctly, when you call it, it is so perverse that it is almost ironic, and that is why this is peripheral. Is that correct?
So the idea of the Anglo-Saxon race is not peripheral at all. What I mean by peripheral is James's relation to England. But you're right that his Anglo-Saxonism represents a perverse loyalty, as he constantly highlights the irrationality of his loyalty to England. Now, what I find interesting is that this perverse loyalty yields aesthetic resources that can result in surprising effects. Let me give you an example. One of the texts I examined is the story titled The Beast in the Jungle. In this story, an English civil servant lives in fearful anticipation of an undefined catastrophe. Now, many critics have examined this text through the lens of morality and sexuality. My reading is that the story is partly a satire of an English bureaucrat. And I look at how James plays with some of the dominant tropes in British imperial discourses, discourses relating to British civil service and colonial adventure. By uncovering the geopolitical implications of the story, I show that the psychic void at the center of the protagonist's life points to a desert-like emptiness, a traumatic meaninglessness that characterizes Britain's imperial project. And that's why I titled that chapter, The Perversity of Empire. James is deploying or engaging with the inconsistencies and contradictions within British imperial discourses, using them as aesthetic resources for a more vigorous and disruptive social imagination.
Yeah. Now let's move to the second author, which is James Joyce. And when you begin, you talk about how and why critics are divided over his postcolonial heritage. Could you address an idea for us, for the listeners?
Yeah. So since the 90s, there has been a wave of postcolonial criticism on Joyce. But most scholars would regard him as an opponent of imperialism. They would focus on his anti-imperial ethos and the subversive energies in his writing. So the rejection of empire has been a long-standing critical consensus in Joyce studies. But recently, there are scholars who have begun to reassess Joyce's relation to England. So my chapter continues this exploration of a British Joyce, as opposed to an Irish Joyce or a European Joyce. And I do this by examining the formal design of Ulysses, which was published in 1922, the year of the creation of the Irish Free State. So Joyce's opinions on British imperialism elude easy summary, but I show that in Ulysses, his aesthetic experiments amount to an effort to suspend linearity and continuity of all kinds, including the teleological foundations of nationalism, Irish revivalism, and decolonization. So it's not that he is indifferent to Irish politics, but that he takes the political impasse in late colonial Ireland as an opportunity to explore radical possibilities of community.
And you have used the concept of negative community to talk about his lateness. Could you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, so I borrow this concept of the negative community from the work of Maurice Blanchot, particularly his book, The Unavowable Community, which is in turn a response to a book by Jean-Luc Nancy titled The Inoperative Community. So Nancy and Blanchot challenged what they call the community of immanence, which is a community that carries its own essence and centers around a shared identity. Instead, they argue that community consists in a ceaseless negation of immanence. Community carries no inner essence. It is not totalizable, but must remain open to the infiniteness of alterity. So this question of community is an urgent one in Ulysses, given the political context of Irish independence. And in fact, Joyce alludes to the genre of national epic and raises the question of what is a nation at key moments in Ulysses. So my chapter contrasts two forms of community in Ulysses. One can be called the positive community, and this positive community is most explicitly thematized in the episode Cyclops. The positive community privileges unity, sovereignty, and reciprocity. The negative community, by contrast, is predicated on incommensurable alterity. It is predicated on what cannot be assimilated into any categories of identity. Now, Blanchot argues that the negative community can be realized through literary writing, because writing entails the negation of self-determinacy and the exposure to the anonymity of language. In other words, there is a constitutive negativity in writing that forces the writer to relinquish all claims of sovereignty or mastery. So I read the Oxen of the Sun episode in Ulysses as an example of this negative community of literary writing. In this episode, Joyce imitates the literary styles of English writers, but he never identifies which writers he is imitating. So the episode mimics the genre of the multi-author anthology, but it never allows the reader to come up with a definitive list of authors' names. The reader's efforts at attribution can never be completed. Instead, the merging of unattributed literary styles leads to an experience of an anonymous alterity that cannot be bound by any form of identity. By enacting this negative community, the Oxen episode represents a unique response to the political debates on Irish Home Rule and republicanism, and also on the institution of English language and literature at the time of the book's composition.
If we could now also talk about Doris Lessing, and how does her work elaborate on the lateness?
Yeah, so I look at Doris Lessing through the lens of what I call late realism. So Lessing grew up in southern Rhodesia and only arrived in England at the age of 30. She wrote about her experience in the Golden Oak book, which remains her most famous work and is often read through the lens of modernism or postmodernism. But she has also incorporated the same experience into another work, a five-volume series titled Children of Violence, which is written in the realist vein. So in literary studies, there is a tradition of pitting realism against modernism. And I use Lessing's work to demonstrate that this realism-modernism dichotomy is geographically and geopolitically conditioned. This realism/modernism binary might make sense in the metropolitan context, but in the colonial periphery where Lessing grew up, realist and modernist practices are not in opposition, but rather can be deployed simultaneously to reflect different aspects of the same historical experience. So in Children of Violence, Lessing sees herself as the latecomer to 19th century realism, And there is this sense of belatedness in her depiction of Southern Rhodesian life. But we can also understand her lateness in another sense, which is that she recycles literary genres and literary tropes and images from the heyday of empire. Like the other writers in my book, Lessing's formative years in Southern Rhodesia were marked by her voracious reading of English literature. But what's interesting about her is that is her continued investment in these outmoded literary conventions that define the imperial age. So I think a key feature of Lessing's late realism is repetition, right? So so if we look at her her experimental novels, such as the memoirs of a survivor, Lessing seems more interested in revisiting obsolete forms than in seeking innovation. She repeats familiar elements such as colonial romance, adventure, settler domesticity, Englishness, and so on. But then she also undercuts their original connotations of improvement and progress. So these literary remnants of the British Empire, if you will, are left in their fossilized form, and they brim with a deep sense of untimeliness.
And you say that in her realist fiction, she is problematizing referentiality. Is that correct?
Yeah, so let me try to define referentiality. So when it comes to realism in fiction, referentiality usually means the capacity for a mimetic portrayal of reality, right? So I don't want to go too much into theories of realism, but let me just note that there is a tendency in recent scholarship to sidestep the question of referentiality, because scholars want to show that realism is not just a mimetic portrayal, right? It's not just a transparent representation of reality. Rather, realism is a more complex and multi-layered rhetorical project. And my claim is that referentiality depends on geographical location. To put it simply, not all places have the same referential value. In Children of Violence, the narrator's favorite activity is reading. She immerses herself in Victorian novels and other English books. At the same time, she is disappointed that the colonial society she lives in does not resemble the literary England she imagines. So in a strange way, the fictional world in books is more real than her reality. In the first few volumes of the series, there is a sense of reality coming from elsewhere. There's this constant tension between the representation of reality and the worthiness of that representation. So referentiality is at stake in Children of Violence because it is not measured in terms of mimetic portrayal, but in terms of colonial reality's resemblance to the fictional worlds in Victorian novels.
Yeah. And if we could also move to the fourth author, the critic Nixon says that V.S. Naipaul is not a good post-colonial subject. And I almost smiled when I read that. Could you tell us why would someone claim that he's not a good post-colonial subject?
Yeah, so so Rob Nixon is not alone in criticizing Naipaul. Naipaul is indeed a very controversial writer. So Nixon famously calls Naipaul the post-colonial Mandarin. And there are other scholars who have accused Naipaul of Eurocentrism, of being unsympathetic to colonial peoples. So I don't question the validity of many of these criticisms of Naipaul. My point is simply that Nixon's denigration of Naipaul as a post-colonial Mandarin antithetically projects his ideal post-colonial subject. So Naipaul is bad because he fails to contest Western stereotypes and voice alternative viewpoints, which means that a good post-colonial subject is someone who can do those things. right? So because Naipaul's critics have been so specific about what he fails to do, they in effect prescribe a set of guidelines for postcolonial writing. My chapter on Naipaul shows that he is far from complacent. Rather, the value of his work lies in its internalization of the irreparable psychic and cultural damage brought about by colonial history.
Like your discussion of the book says, that he uses enchantment as a practice to question these assumptions. Could you tell us how he, as an example of how he does that?
Yeah. So I was really interested in why Naipaul keeps invoking the child's perspective. You know, why he keeps imagining the way a child would see the world. And this is most evident in his early fiction, such as Meagle Street and The Mystic Masseur. But we can also find that rhetoric of enchantment in his later works, such as The Enigma of Arrival. And my claim is that this trope of childhood innocence arises in a dialectical relation to colonial shame, the shame not only of being a colonial subject, but of confronting the humiliating history of colonialism. So through the eyes of the child, Naipaul can ward off the debilitating effect of colonial knowledge. In other words, enchantment is a compensation for disenchantment. The child in Naipaul's work is an artificial construct. It is a tool for shame management. It is a deliberate effort to sustain an innocent view of the world against all odds. It is an effort to imagine a world without shame. So to give you an example, the core part of my Naipaul chapter is an extended analysis of The Enigma of Arrival. Now, this is a difficult book to write about because it seems to crystallize the image of Naipaul as a compliant colonial succumbing to the allure of England. I read this book as a full-fledged theory of colonial enchantment. The book is a fictionalized record of his years residing at a manor estate in Wiltshire, and he calls this period of his life his second childhood. At the beginning of the book, he arrives at a seemingly timeless landscape of rural England. The rest of the book is a slow process of demystification. The narrator realizes that what seems to be a perfect rural order and a timeless landscape is, in fact, part of a longer history of colonial expansion, a history that connects the residents of that manor estate with his own family's history of migration from India to Trinidad. But in learning to see that landscape, not as timeless, but as historical, the narrator also preserves, or rather enacts, the child's way of seeing, a vision that bars all historical knowledge. So that to demystify England is to relive the magic, to experience his initial enchantment in a more intense way. So I show that The Enigma of Arrival proceeds through this unique dialectic of historicization and enchantment. It is through the child's vision that the narrator can confront colonial history without being held captive by shame.
Yeah, and that's a very thoughtful perspective on things. Thank you, Dr. Sang. At the end of the podcast, I would like to ask you, what do you hope the readers to take from this text?
I hope my readers will see my book as offering a complementary approach to empire studies and postcolonial studies. As I said earlier, attachment is not a key word in postcolonial studies, but my book shows that imperial attachments are everywhere. Without looking at those attachments, we cannot account for the continuing prestige of British culture in today's world. So there hasn't been much scholarship on imperial attachments because attachment to England sounds conservative or even backward-looking. And until very recently, there hasn't been much scholarship on attachment in literary studies. So I hope my book can demonstrate that attachment is not affirmation or endorsement. To be attached to English culture doesn't mean affirming or endorsing it, especially when that attachment is unrequited. As I suggested earlier, imperial attachments can be as disruptive and subversive as anti-colonial discourses. And finally, thinking beyond the British Empire, I hope that my book can call for more attention to all kinds of improper desires and unrequited longings in our collective imagination today. Sometimes I think that attachment is a predicament because we don't always get to choose what to be attached to, right? We can't always choose our objects of attachment or explain why we are attached to them. So the ideal would be to renounce all attachments. But because that is impossible, or at least very difficult to do, examining attachments at the individual and collective levels can reveal a lot about the violence and trauma that we are subject to. We can learn to denaturalize attachments and live with them, even when they cause us pain. In a world of migrants, refugees, and half-citizens, I don't think those models of cosmopolitan dialogue or alternative modernities can fully account for the challenges we face. My book proposes that we need to look at those unacknowledged or illegitimate desires and attachments to understand the messy complexity of cross-cultural interactions.
Thank you so much, and I hope you have a nice day and a productive writing ahead of you.